I'm going to go ahead and read the thing. I've got a math problem for you. If a train enters a station going 25 miles an hour, or 40 miles an hour, and its brakes fail, how long will it take to stop? In October of 1895, the Granville-Paris Express ended up smashing through the station and coming out the other side, killing a woman. On this episode of Relative Disasters, the Montparnasse Derailment. Welcome to Relative Disasters, the show where I dig too greedily and too deep, put those delvings into a podcast, and send it out to my sister and anyone else who feels like listening. My much cooler big sister and I manage our existential dread by talking with each other about terrible and interesting historical events, their context, implications, and any related sidebars that tend to distract me. My name is Greg, my sister's name is Ella, and Ella, today we're going to be talking about a train crash that resulted in one death and one of the most iconic photos of the late 1800s. Our source for this episode is L'Accident de la Guerre Montparnasse by Monsieur Richoux for La Nature, published in November of 1895, as well as supplementary and contemporary articles regarding the crash. Gare Montparnasse, the Montparnasse station, was opened in 1840 and rebuilt in 1852. Paris is a big city, and Montparnasse is one of the seven major railway terminals serving the city. On October 22, 1895, the Granville-Paris Express, led by locomotive 721, was leaving from Granville at about 8:45 in the morning. The train was 12 cars long. Two luggage vans and a postal van were coupled to the locomotive, followed by eight passenger carriages and another luggage van at the end. She carried 131 passengers. Its expected arrival time was just before 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Its driver was Guillaume Pellerin, a 19-year veteran, and he really wanted the train to come in on time. As it was, when the Granville-Paris Express approached Montparnasse, she was about 5 to 10 minutes behind schedule, and Pellerin was trying everything he could to make up for the lost time. Locomotive 721 was a 240 steam locomotive, known in North America as a porter. 240 means that it has two leading wheels on one axle and four powered and coupled driving wheels on two axles with no trailing wheels. If you look at the locomotive from the side, you'll see three wheels, a smaller wheel in the front, and two larger wheels behind it joined by a metal bar. In France, these were called the 120 class. Now, trains at the time generally had two different braking systems, one to serve as a backup to the other. Locomotive 721 had standard brakes consisting of a shoe made out of cast iron that presses against the wheel to slow the train, in a way that's similar to car brakes. 721 also had the high-tech Westinghouse air brake system, which was an air braking system that used a loss of air pressure to clamp its brakes into place. Most air brake systems would flood their lines with air pressure to clamp their brakes. The Westinghouse was unique in that it functioned with a loss of air pressure, so it could serve as an emergency backup. If anything cut the pressure to the pipes, the locks would come down and the wheels would be stopped. They also used brake shoes, but they were capable of stopping a train quicker than other methods because of being installed on each individual car in the train and being able to exert more pressure on those brake shoes. Now, the trouble with the Westinghouse is that it wasn't super reliable. They could fail in rough conditions, and they wouldn't activate if they'd been used too recently before their air chambers could completely fill again. In his efforts to get into the station quickly, Pellerin decided to approach at speed and then apply the Westinghouse brakes. It was against regulations to do all of that. Approaching at speed is extremely dangerous. The Westinghouse brakes' reliability, or lack thereof, was a well-known issue, and railway management had a policy of not trusting them exclusively. And of course, though, arriving later than promised would get the driver in trouble with management. So he made his decision, coming into the station between 40 and 60 kilometers per hour, between 25 and almost 40 miles an hour, in a train that weighed over 100 tons. Pellerin pulled the Westinghouse brake, and to the shock of no one paying attention, it failed. So he pulled the standard brake, which was meant to slow the train over a much longer distance, miles, not feet, and needless to say, physics won. The train smashed through the buffer stop barrier at the end of the track, drove about 100 feet across the concourse itself, smashed through the 2-foot-thick wall of the station, and dove 30 feet down into the street, where it finally stopped on its face. Outside, a newspaper vendor had asked his wife, Marie Auguste Aguilar, to mind the stand while he went to go get the evening newspapers. The damage from the train caused some of the station's masonry to fall, and she was killed when it landed on her. She was the only casualty, however. A few passengers were injured, but that was it. The driver was uninjured, and the locomotive itself, when they were finally able to move it, had suffered only cosmetic damage and was able to be put back into use quickly. The majority of the cars had stopped while in the station. Only the tender car and the locomotive, and I think one of the postal cars, actually wound up on the ground. An inquiry was done, and the blame was laid squarely at the feet of Monsieur Pellerin. He was fined 50 francs for approaching the station too fast, and sentenced to 2 months in prison for the reckless conduct and the damage. However, he was never required to serve that time. One of the conductors was also fined 25 francs, since it was supposed to be his job to apply the Westinghouse brake, and he was doing paperwork instead of manning his station on the approach. The railway company reached a settlement with the Aguillard family. They paid for her funeral and set up a pension fund to help provide for their 2 children. In the aftermath of the crash, policies regarding approach and speed were revisited and made more stringent. However, similar crashes would occur, and continue to occur, as speed and maintaining the schedules were financially incentivized and public safety was not. And that's it. That's the story of one of the most famous examples of somebody going off track, the Montparnasse derailment. Here at Relative Disasters, we make sure to fact-check our work to bring you the most accurate disasters possible. If you'd like to know more about our sources, they're cited at the beginning of the episode. Sometimes we do make mistakes, of course, so if you have any thoughts to share or corrections we need to know, please write to us at relative.disasters@gmail.com. We cannot respond to emails, but we do read every single one, even the spam. Some days I get really good spam. Or if you'd like to shame us publicly, and we know you do, why not try our Instagram, @relative.disasters. A big thank you to our patrons who support us on Patreon. You guys are great and help us justify keeping this podcast ad-free. We'd like to thank, as always, our major disasters, Katie and Georgia, for their support. And this week's episode is brought to you by Lynn, who's never crashed a train, but not for lack of trying, and Bernadette, who knows a thing or two about keeping things on track. Thank you all so much for joining us for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed the story, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Ella, next week we're going back out into the ocean on a deep-sea drilling rig, and we're going to talk about one of the most gruesome ways to die. On the next episode of Relative Disasters, we're going to visit the Byford Dolphin Explosive Decompression Incident. Have a good week, and I'll see you then.